I'm Dr. Sagar Lonial from the Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. And what I'd like to talk a little bit about is personalizing treatment and the new revised international staging system criteria that was recently published by the International Myeloma Working Group. So as we begin to talk about this, let's do a little bit of background on the history of risk assessment in the context of multiple myeloma. And as you can see from this curve, it's pretty clear that treatments over the last decade or so have had significant impacts in terms of progression-free and overall survival for cohorts of patients based on the time of their diagnosis. And in large part, this does reflect the fact that we've had many new treatments approved in the last 5 to 10 years, and we are more commonly using high-dose therapy and autologous transplantation for the management of appropriate patients with newly diagnosed symptomatic myeloma as well. And these two things coupled together have allowed us to actually move the natural history of myeloma curve from a median survival of only 3 to 3.5 years many decades ago, now to expected median survivals of between 7 and 10 years. And that doesn't necessarily even include the 4 new drugs that we've had approved in the last 12 months. Now, despite much of this improvement in progression-free and overall survival, there still remains about a 25% group of patients who have a median survival of less than 3 years. And trying to identify who those patients are so that we can optimally first identify them, and then secondly, tailor treatments to help those patients get more aggressive maintenance therapy approaches or novel treatment approaches is really an important part of what we're striving to do in the context of improving outcomes for patients with multiple myeloma. So what are the factors that determine high-risk disease? Well, there are a number of patient-specific factors and disease-specific factors that really play into this. The first among the patient-specific factors is age, comorbidities such as concomitant renal failure, cardiac function failure, or poor cardiac reserve. And the third, obviously, is frailty. And frailty is an important thing to consider because frailty does have significant impact on our ability to deliver effective combination therapy, especially to older patients, but this may apply to younger patients as well. Now, there are a number of disease-specific factors that are important as well. These include ISS stage, adverse cytogenetics, patients with a high LDH, MRD, and adverse cytogenetics, and these are certainly important in trying to determine the intensity and duration of maintenance therapy. High numbers of circulating plasma cells, not even necessarily plasma cell leukemia, though that certainly does confer a high-risk patient, but even having 1 or 2% circulating plasma cells is prognostically worse than having less than 1% circulating plasma cells. Extramedullary disease, this is certainly a really important endpoint and does not necessarily include patients who have bone-based extramedullary disease, but really relates to patients that have non-bone-based extramedullary disease. And there is some controversy about failure to respond as a potential disease-specific factor. I think that that really depends on what treatment is being employed. And as we know, for a long period of time, there has been this debate in the myeloma community about 2 drugs versus 3 drugs. Failure to respond to a 2-drug induction regimen is probably different than failure to respond to a 3-drug induction regimen. And that may be less of an issue now, as most patients are receiving triplet-based induction in 2016. So what about MM classification over time? If we begin to look at the way that we've classified myeloma, you can see quite clearly that what we've been relegated to until the last 5 years or so has been microscopic evaluation of the bone marrow by a pathologist. And while this was useful to tell us, yes, a patient has clonal and what look like malignant plasma cells, it didn't really give us significant insights into differences and heterogeneity amongst patients, as well as even within a patient, what we call intraclonal heterogeneity. We could not appreciate any of that when all we really had to go by was routine light microscopy. Now, we started to use biomarkers to try and predict survival and progression-free survival for patients, and this began initially with the use of the beta-2 microglobulin. And what was identified almost a decade ago was that the beta-2 microglobulin was in fact able to differentiate 3 different groups of patients. you could identify patients with very poor risk disease who had a high beta-2 microglobulin, or patients with very good risk disease who had a low beta-2 microglobulin. And when one began to try and put these things together into risk-adapted stratification, this is one of the tools that was used to initiate how we risk stratify patients. Again, high beta-2 had a very short overall survival with a median overall survival of less than 2 years versus a low beta-2, which had a median survival that was not even reached with a follow-up of almost 8 to 10 years, as you can see from this specific criteria. Now, based on that, the International Staging System criteria was created back in 2005, and it basically linked both the beta-2 microglobulin and the albumin and created ISS stage 1, stage 2, and stage 3 patients. And I think it's important to realize that this ISS staging replaced the Dury-Salmon staging. Dury-Salmon, the grading of 1, 2, and 3 with A and B based on renal function, is no longer used to risk assess patients in 2016. It is not a useful metric, it's an old metric, and really its function was to identify tumor burden, not necessarily prognostic risk. The ISS staging, which replaced the Dury-Salmon staging, is much more effective at giving us predicted median overall survivals. As you can see, patients with ISS 3 have a median survival of 30 months versus double that in patients with ISS 1. So this does have both clinical and ease of utility benefits from an average practicing clinician. Now, as we began to go from just light microscopy to using certain biomarkers to try and predict outcomes such as the ISS, it was subsequently identified that there were genetic differences between patients with multiple myeloma. And there were patients that had primary IGH translocations, patients that basically had non-hyperdiploid abnormalities. There were patients that had no IGH translocations, but had what we now call a hyperdiploid type myeloma. And then there were some overlaps where the ploidy was somewhat variable. And each of these different sets of patients had different prognostic risks and outcomes compared to other patients that, again, using light microscopy, all appeared to be the same. And this was an important step forward, led by investigators such as Rafael Fonseca, Hervé Avet-Lasseau from the IFM, Nikhil Munshi from the Dana-Farber Group, and others that really began to question whether just blood biomarkers and light microscopy was sufficient to help us differentiate risks of patients. And as you can see from this slide, we've identified now that there are, in fact, common abnormalities that occur. These can include translocations or trisomies. And in fact, trisomies without IGH abnormalities, which are basically the hyperdiploid subset of patients, these represent roughly 40% of patients in the context of newly diagnosed myeloma. And that's good news because these are patients that have very good outcomes. In fact, with modern myeloma therapy, if you fall into this category, hyperdiploidy, you basically have a median expected survival of greater than 10 years based on very nice, large randomized data. There are, however, other genetic abnormalities that perhaps don't fare quite as well. And these include patients with IGH abnormalities without trisomies that form roughly a third of patients, additional who have IGH abnormalities with trisomies, another 15%, cytogenetic abnormalities in and of themselves, and monosomy 14 in the absence of IGH translocations. And again, these are groups of patients that all have very different expected progression-free and overall survivals. And this is really critically important because as we're beginning to think about how to treat these patients, one should potentially think about these patients in a different fashion. Now, what are some of these abnormalities? And let's go through that a little bit more specifically. There are, in fact, abnormalities that confer a poor prognosis. And I would argue any patient with conventional cytogenetic abnormalities represents a poor risk subset of patients. This represents 15% of all patients that have regular karyotyping done, and the fact that they have a karyotypic abnormality tells us that their myeloma cells are proliferating at a higher rate compared to other patients. Patients with the 414 translocation, patients with 17p deletion, patients with 1q gain, Patients with 1P deletions are not quite as clear that they have a poor risk prognosis in isolation, and additional analyses are currently being performed to confirm that. And patients that have a hypodiploid karyotype, those are patients clearly with poor risk genetics. Now, what about abnormalities that do not confer poor risk? These are considered standard risk or somewhat neutral. These include patients with 1114 translocation, 614 translocation, hyperdiploidy, as I mentioned before, and the one that is often quite confusing is deletion 13. Deletion 13 without 414 and without 17p deletion is in fact considered neutral. It has no negative prognostic factor. That was actually proven to us by the IFM over time. Now let's look specifically at the 414 subset of patients. These are patients, again, you can see from a large old trial done in Canada where the expected progression-free and overall survival for 414 patients was less than 2 years for PFS, with median expected survival also of less than 2 years as well, suggesting that patients with 414 translocation do in fact have a very poor progression-free and overall survival. But it's important to realize that not all patients with 414 are the same. So the genetics in isolation does not give you all the answers. And so if you begin to put these things together, what you can begin to see is that all 414s in blue are in yellow versus non-414s in blue, you can see a clear difference in progression-free and overall survival. However, if you begin to separate out the 414s based on beta 2 and hemoglobin at presentation, you can see quite nicely that there are patients with a low beta 2 and a normal hemoglobin in the green curve who have 414 and whose expected progression-free and overall survival is no different from patients who don't have 414 translocation. On the other hand, the light blue curve on the right side suggests that if you have a high beta 2 and a low hemoglobin and 414, expected overall survival is less than 2 years. Again, speaking to the fact that biomarkers in combination with genetics may help us to really tailor which patients have the best and which patients ultimately have the worst prognosis over time. Now let's look again at 414 and 17p deletion based on retrospective data that Shaji Kumar has published in Blood a few years ago. If you have 414, you can see a very different survival in yellow versus if you don't. On the other hand, if you look at 17p deletion, a very different survival than if you don't have 17p abnormalities in the blue curve there as well. These important genetic and FISH-based assessments can give you important prognostic and predictive markers for progression-free and overall survival. Now, when the group in France actually began to look at multiple covariates and risk of progression, they identified three different independent variables looking at multivariate analysis that predicted bad survival. The first was a high LDH. Not a surprise, patients with a high LDH clearly have a worse overall survival than patients with a normal LDH. The second was beta 2 microglobulin. If you had a high beta 2 as an independent predictor of survival, those patients did a lot worse than patients who didn't. And the third was the 414 translocation and or the 17p deletion. And so of all the variables that were looked at in terms of patient, disease, and age-specific criteria, these three fell out in multivariate analysis as being the most important predictors of progression-free and early death in patients with newly diagnosed myeloma. And based on that, Philippe Moreau proposed in the IFM analysis to create a scoring system that broke patients up into four categories. You had no adverse events, you had one of those three, you had an LDH plus ISS stage 3 without 414, or you had 414 in addition to ISS stage 3 or high LDH. And this gave rise to what was initially published by Philippe Moreau, putting patients into a new revised scoring system that really can nicely differentiate survival at 2 years based on whether or not you have a score of 0, 1, 2, or 3. And again, this now gave rise to what we will use in the revised ISS system, because that 1,600 patient analysis was then broadened to a much larger group of patients. And as you can see from Dr. Palumbo's paper published in JCO last year, it's basically taken that framework used the ISS staging 1, 2, and 3, added additional criteria of either absence